From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Amnesty International released a major report on Thursday about U.S.-led massacres of more than 1,600 civilians in Raqqa, Syria, from June to October of 2017. The report, entitled Rhetoric versus Reality in the War in Raqqa, found that the U.S. and its allies bombed the city indiscriminately in order to oust the Islamic State. Whole families were wiped out, and the U.S. has yet to acknowledge its role or the extent of the loss of life. And then earlier in the week, a new UN report on the Afghanistan war concluded that U.S.-backed Afghan government forces, along with U.S. and other foreign troops, were responsible for killing more Afghan civilians in the first 3 months of this year than the Taliban and other insurgent groups. And on Tuesday, U.S. ally and weapons buyer Saudi Arabia beheaded 37 of its citizens in a mass execution for what it called terrorism-related crimes. AP reported that the Saudis' medieval-style justice included publicly pinning one of the bodies and its severed head to a pole as a warning to others. Saudi Arabia continues to bombard neighboring Yemen with U.S.-bought weapons and U.S. military advice. Joining me to analyze the surge in death and destruction by U.S. hands under President Trump is Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome, Corey.
Thank you.
So this report by Amnesty in Syria, I wanted to start with that first. I mean, it's sort of hard to know where to start. The reports about the U.S. being responsible directly or indirectly for mass death and destruction in all these countries is so varied that we can start with the largest number of casualties for 1,600 civilians, as per Amnesty International, killed over the span of several months in Raqqa, Syria, as the U.S. was bombarding this city. What were your initial impressions of this report and its importance?
Right. Well, my initial response was, yeah, this is just the horror of what the U.S. has done in Raqqa and what the U.S. has denied doing. I was also, I must say, very impressed with how comprehensive the report is and the kind of methodologies that Amnesty and their collaborators in Air Wars employed were really quite impressive for painting this important and very dark picture of what the United States did and is doing. And the last thing is just that this is really one example of the U.S.'s ongoing so-called war on terror, which has been carrying out for over 17 years now, and which it has largely rendered invisible, but it continues in country after country around the world. And here we have a glimpse of what it looked like in Raqqa.
Now, this particular report, I thought also very importantly juxtaposed the U.S. rhetoric with the reality on the ground. So the U.S. military spokespeople literally claimed there were no responsibilities. So, for example, the report quoted Lieutenant General Stephen J. Townsend, who said, "I challenge anyone to find a more precise air campaign in the history of warfare. The coalition's goal is always for zero human casualties." I mean, so they literally haven't acknowledged a single death?
Right. I mean, it's simply false. And it's really important, actually, to talk about that, because that rhetoric is so important to the whole U.S. way of war making in general, and the way that the United States represents itself on the world stage. And certainly for those of us who live inside of the United States, what we hear is that the United States, this is the force for good around the world, and that unlike the enemies that the U.S. fights, the U.S. takes great pains to avoid civilian casualties. That is the kind of rhetoric that characterizes U.S. war making in general, but it has a particular role in the so-called war on terror, which counterposes the idea of these terrorists who are attacking civilians indiscriminately to the United States, which employs all of these efforts, including surgical and precision methods of aerial attack to make sure that they're killing only terrorists. And it's simply false. I mean, the very nature of an air campaign over a city as densely populated as Raqqa means that civilian casualties are going to occur. And the United States knows that. And that's happened in cities all across the world where the U.S. is carrying out this war.
Right. So essentially, the US, when dropping these bombs, there's no way that you would be avoiding civilian casualties. And of course, where the civilians in Raqqa were concerned, they were prevented from leaving, at least that's what the report suggests, by the Islamic State on the ground, a fact that the US and its allies should have known as it bombarded this city for months from June to October of 2017, right? There were, you know, 10 people killed one day, 15 another day, whole families wiped out. But ultimately, what the U.S. was saying in its bombardment of Raqqa was that it was going in there to help civilians, right? To save these trapped civilians from the Islamic State alongside the goal of wiping out the Islamic State. I mean, that's what some of the survivors told Amnesty. We were supposed to be the ones the U.S. was protecting. Instead, it was killing us.
Right. I mean, it's false on so many levels. First of all, yeah, with the most basic knowledge of what ISIS was doing in Raqqa, we know that civilians were not allowed to leave by the way that ISIS was ruling that place. And so we know that civilians were kept captive in the city. The United States knew that. So that's one thing. But the other thing, it's very important that Amnesty and Air Wars have documented what was really an aerial attack on a captive civilian population. But it's also worth looking at what the United States has done since, which also points to the fact that it absolutely is not, that the purpose, the objective was not to save or help civilians in Raqqa. So the fact that there has been no reconstruction, this has been documented by journalists like Lama Oarian and Ruth Sherlock, have pointed out that in the years since this massive bombing campaign, there has not been the reconstruction, which the United States promised would take place afterward. In addition to all of the things that the United States has done to prevent Syrian refugees from leaving Syria, that is, we know that the U.S. has done so much to prevent Syrians from entering the United States, but in terms of the funding that it's given to allies like Jordan, which neighbors Syria, for example, it also prevents Syrians from leaving. And so in many, many ways, the United States has shown that it's absolutely not only disinterested in the lives of civilians, but really treats them with utter contempt. It subjects them to incredible violence at every step, from the air campaigns that the U.S. carries out to its failure or its disinterest in rebuilding their cities after destroying them, to confining people to Syria once they try to leave.
Right. The coalition has admitted that it killed 159 civilians. Amnesty found 1,600, so a tenfold difference. And the other thing that the report pointed out was that the coalition, the U.S.-led coalition, could have taken even minimal steps to reduce casualties and didn't. For example, they could have had some surveillance before launching their strikes to prevent this many civilian casualties. I mean, to me, this suggests that the civilian casualties was not something that the U.S. was even trying to avoid. I mean, what does that mean? You know, when we think about the terrorist attacks that just took place in Sri Lanka, where more than 300 people were killed, how is the U.S.'s action in Raqqa any different from those terrorist attacks, right?
Right. So it's a good question. And I think there are two things happening here. The first is the very notion that the United States could possibly and has the right to invade a country to identify and kill the so-called bad guys. That whole notion is just so wrong. The idea that the United States is able to distinguish between those who deserve to be killed and those who don't. Who gave the United States that authority? That's authority that the United States simply assumed. So the whole premise of this particular set of operations, but really the whole war on terror, that whole premise is wrong. The other thing that's worth saying is when we talk about questions of civilian casualties, and I think that Amnesty in particular has done very important work on this, the whole U.S. definition of what constitutes a civilian is something that it's really important to examine, because the fact is that the United States has operated in Syria, in Yemen, in Somalia, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere, it is operated such that it considers all males of a certain age in a certain area to be combatants, and therefore they can be subject to U.S. violence. And truthfully, the United States has carried out operations where it identifies particular areas where anybody within those areas can be a target. It, you know, is considered a combatant and therefore is defined out of the very idea of who constitutes a civilian. And so, you know, according to the U.S. logic, when they say, well, we've killed 500 terrorists, on one hand, which they said that they did in Somalia, you know, in Iraq, similarly, they said, we've killed all of these ISIS members. So on one hand, they are just lying. It's simply false. And again, it's easily, I mean, if Amnesty International, which does not have the resources of the U.S. Department of Defense, is able to identify when children are being killed, then certainly the U.S. Department of Defense does, and they're choosing not to. But it's also the case that they consider certain people who live in certain areas to all be combatants, to all be terrorists, right, and so on. And so really, it's very important for us to say, to talk about that and really confront the racism that identifies people in majority Muslim countries, people of color in certain areas in war zones, that says that these people are all subject to U.S. violence. That whole thing we have to challenge.
Let's turn to the other massacring of civilians that the U.S. has been engaging in, and that's in the longest official war the U.S. has ever waged, Afghanistan. So we'd been supposedly waiting for results from ongoing peace talks between the U.S. and Taliban. Those talks have been going on for months, if not years. And the United Nations just released a report, just a day or two before the Syria amnesty report, finding that pro-government forces, meaning the U.S.-backed government and the U.S. itself, caused more civilian deaths than even the Taliban and other insurgent groups. So hundreds of civilian killed, more of them killed by the U.S. Should we consider this part of the same negligence that the U.S. has fought the Syria war, that sort of callous indifference towards the lives of civilians?
Yeah, I think absolutely. This is, again, really part and parcel of the whole war on terror, in which you see are different versions of these same acts, that whether they're taking place in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Yemen, in Somalia, in Pakistan, et cetera. Now, on one hand, again, there's something that's disruptive that can be surprising, that lands in a surprising way about a report. When you hear the idea that the United States killed more people than the Taliban, There's something that's disruptive about that, because what we hear is that forces like the Taliban, forces like ISIS, et cetera, that these are the killers. These are the ones who have no regard for human life.
And we're supposedly saving Afghans from these killers, right? Instead, we're killing them alongside the Taliban.
Right, exactly. Like on one, it's that the United States is supposed to be the defender. It casts itself as the defender of civilians against forces like the Taliban, but also the United States is supposed to be operating along a different ethical code than the Taliban. That is, whereas the Taliban doesn't respect life, the United States does respect life. So that's why it can appear to be, there can be something disruptive about hearing a report like this, but it really shouldn't be surprising when you consider, again, I mean, when you consider the Taliban is using all kinds of horrendous methods of killing, including car bombs and improvised explosive devices, et cetera. The United States has aircraft and the whole arsenal of the U.S. military, which it is using itself and then arming the Afghan government's military with as well, which are, it makes sense that that would be more destructive. It's also the case that there is just at this point a long history, even the recent history of what the U.S. has done in Afghanistan since 2001, 2002, has been horrendous. In 2015, when it bombed a Doctors Without Borders hospital, for example, a crime for which nobody in the U.S., none of the personnel involved in that attack were held accountable. So this is horrendous, it's inexcusable, But it is also really the latest act of violence in what has been a whole string of violence that continues as long as the United States continues its occupation of Afghanistan.
Let's turn to Saudi Arabia. Of course, this isn't a country where the U.S. is directly dropping bombs, but it's working with Saudis to drop bombs on Yemen. However, the news that just emerged was the set of mass beheadings that the U.S. weapons buyer and strong ally Saudi Arabia engaged in, 37 people killed, executed by the government for so-called terrorism-related crimes. Among them, I believe, was one young person who was executed for having attended a few pro-democracy demonstrations in the past. He was scheduled to start university in the United States as a student. He was among those killed. I mean, if any other country that the U.S., you know, just picture if Venezuela had carried out such mass beheadings, this would be something that Mike Pompeo would be standing up on his podium at the State Department and denouncing and using as a basis for more sanctions, right?
Right. Well, I mean, for me, the really obvious contrast is always Iran, which is also like an Islamic government, which the United States demonizes routinely, which the United States has imposed the target, not the Iranian government, but the Iranian population. The United States claims that Iran is the sponsor of terror, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And it recently put on the terrorist watch list the Iranian National Guard, right?
Right, exactly. Because of, and this is, you know, it's true that the Iranian government has horrendous human rights abuses. But Saudi Arabia is you know, right next door, also carrying out these horrific abuses with the absolute support, really at every level, by the United States. Diplomatic support in terms of actually supplying the weapons, and that includes Saudi Arabia's crimes that it commits within the kingdom. That it includes what it's doing in Yemen with extensive cooperation by the United States. And of course, we've seen all kinds of protection for years and years over throughout several many U.S. presidential administrations. But Trump, as he often does, makes it so naked the U.S.'s embrace of Saudi violence. It's also worth saying that Saudi Arabia, which has the death penalty, is in that sense it is in the same club as the United States, one of the minority governments in the world that still have the death penalty. So in a way it's not terribly surprising that the United States is willing to look the other way and indeed provide diplomatic and all kinds of other material support to Saudi Arabia for its crimes, when the United States is not only working with Saudi Arabia hand in hand in committing its crimes in the Middle East, but the United States itself is carrying out human rights abuses here.
And then the Yemen bombing, of course, continues. President Trump just, of course, vetoed a resolution that passed both houses of Congress on the ending U.S. support to the Yemen war. And of course, the excuse that the Trump administration and Trump himself has given is that, you know, if this is so that we can sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. It's very lucrative for the U.S. If they don't buy weapons from us, they'd buy them from elsewhere. But it's not that easy. The Intercept just had a report a few weeks ago about how the primary weapons that that Saudi Arabia is using in Yemen are U.S.-bought weapons. And if the U.S. were to cut off weapons, say, it would take years for Saudi Arabia to replenish it from elsewhere and to switch weapon systems. So we're absolutely enabling that war, right?
Oh, at every turn, not only with the incredible sale of weapon systems and what it means that Saudi Arabia, really any client of the United States and its weapon systems, you know, they want these, they build these relationships such that Saudi Arabia is buying weapon systems that are only compatible with other U.S. weapon systems. Their whole military kind of apparatus is really based on these decades of hardware that's sold by the United States. But it's also the case that in its war in Yemen, the United States is supplying intelligence of Saudi Arabia. The United States has been carrying out this mid-air refueling operation to fuel Saudi aircraft, which are also sold by the United States. And the United States has its own personnel on the ground in Yemen as well. So the United States and Saudi Arabia and the UAE are absolutely working hand in hand. And this is, it's so important because, again, this, it goes back to cutting through the rhetoric. The United States on one hand says that it opposes terror, it opposes violence against civilians, and that's why it opposes, you know, with these other forces that declares as enemies as. But Saudi Arabia is doing really quite brazenly the very things abusing human rights in the very ways that the United States claims to oppose. And what that reveals is that the United States is not invested in human rights at all. Rather, the United States is invested in its own power, and Saudi Arabia is a staunch ally in that power. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia have convergent interests in the kind of Middle East and the kind of world that they want to see.
I'm wondering, Corey, if you think it's fair to say that there is very little appetite left within the United States for the kind of death and destruction that is being wrought in all of these countries thanks to the United States. But it's just that we're feeling so inundated with the domestic attacks by the Trump administration that we're distracted from the violence and the mayhem is happening. And yet, of course, when the media cover massacres committed at other hands, all eyes are on it. You know, when there are attacks by groups in Paris, or as we saw in Christchurch, New Zealand, or as we saw in Sri Lanka, there is an inordinate amount of sympathy and sympathetic outpouring and press attention, and just not that same level of attention to the victims of our direct policies, even though it's not something that the U.S. public really wants.
Yeah, you know, I think that the question of why there isn't more of a visible opposition to what the U.S. is doing here and what the U.S. is supporting is a really important question. And I think that you're right that you get at, it's actually, there's a... The answer is a bit complex because on one hand it's true it's not the case that Americans are calling for more invasions and military operations, but on the other hand there is the fact that the U.S. way of making war since 2001 has taken great pains to reduce the number of U.S. casualties, right? And then minimize, in terms of what we see here, those casualties that do occur. And so things like the drone war, things like the use of special operations, and so on, as opposed to conventional forces or using special operations more extensively. That means that we see very few Americans actually getting killed. We know that when the U.S. invaded Iraq, that they made a deliberate choice that when U.S. soldiers were killed, that the coffins would not be broadcast in the media. The media were, the mainstream media complied with that, that kind of request by the Bush administration. And that's the other piece, is the way, as you point out, how the mainstream media are covering this. We have heard about when there are high-profile, horrific attacks by the Taliban in Afghanistan. But we have not heard about, in the U.S. mainstream media, all of the attacks that the United States has committed. And that is why it is so jarring when you hear that the U.S. has committed these massacres, when you hear that the United States is killing more civilians in Afghanistan than the Taliban is, and so on. It's so surprising because there's been so little coverage by the mainstream media of all of that killing. And so I do think that it's important when reports come out like this, that on shows like yours and for those of us who are activists, we have a role to play in terms of highlighting what exactly the United States is doing.
It will come to haunt us in the end, as these wars have always come back. Corey, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest has been Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been discussing the results of Trump's foreign policy in nations like Syria, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and more. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.